Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I am Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Kevin Schatzkammer, author, internationally renowned distinguished systems architect on the evolution and long-term strategy of mobile networks. Kevin, you bring a substantial history of significant and considerable contribution to research, long-term strategy, mobile network architecture, and innovation to this interview. We are indeed very fortunate to have you share your many deep experiences and insights with the audience. Thank you.
Thanks, Stephen. It's good to be here today, and I'm looking forward to a very lively discussion.
Kevin, I was just sort of looking at your background, and it's really, really amazing. So can you outline some of this in your areas of interest?
Sure. So I've been working in the mobile industry and at Cisco for the better part of the last 15 years or so. When I joined Cisco, my focus was on educating internally what the industry and technologies that were defining the mobile landscape were. At that point, we were talking about GSM, we were talking about CDMA, we were talking about digital networks, and the evolution towards data such as GPRS, CDMA1X, and we were even talking and exploring a 19.2 kilobit per second data connection using IDA networks here in the U.S. So I currently hold 15 patents in mobile wireless technologies, everything from load balancing and dual mode access to voice and video over wireless networks. I've published two books with Cisco Press, the first one in 2009 called IP Design for Mobile Networks. That book focused on the increasing role that IP was playing in the delivery of mobile services. And then most recently, last month, published a second book with Cisco Press called Building the Mobile Internet. And Building the Mobile Internet is focused on the technologies that are enabling mobility natively on the Internet.
Well, that's an amazing background and 15 patents. Just amazing. Now, can you explain the relatively sort of static nature of the Internet's original protocols and design?
Sure. So, you know, I wouldn't go so far as to say the Internet itself is static. What I would say is that, you know, there's plenty of techniques that allow the Internet to reconverge itself dynamically, recover from link failures, you know, handle elements that go down. What I would say is that the Internet was not designed with mobility in mind. Instead, it was designed for what I would say is stability rather than static, meaning that the expectation is that the Internet does not experience a large rate of change. And the reason for this is based on the foundation, you know, really upon which the Internet was built, right? And that being an addressing scheme leveraging the Internet protocol. And when we look at the Internet protocol, it was really there and is there to provide two simultaneous functions. One is identifying who the end node is or who the user is that's connecting. And the other is to identify where that end node is. You know, it's a process that's called overloading. And in general, what we see today on the Internet is an IP address is overloaded with simultaneous information that signifies location and identity.
Well, then what are the challenges that mobility presents to conventional Internet architectures?
So that's a great question, right? Very apropos given where we kind of just left off on the last one. What I would say is that, you know, when a subscriber moves, their identity always stays the same, right? You know, my device doesn't change its characteristics as I move from network to network. Me as a user doesn't change as I move from device to device. So as a subscriber is moving, given that their identity is always staying the same, but their location is changing, or, you know, when we consider what location is, it's really their point of attachment to the network is changing, IP model starts to break. Because that IP address is overloaded and signifies both location and identity, you can't just pick up and move your point of attachment without breaking your communication sessions. So what's tended to happen to resolve some of this? We've seen the definition of a number of mobility-specific protocols at multiple layers of the network. We can talk to mobility-specific protocols that have appeared at the link layer, at the internet layer, at the transport layer, at the application layer. And I think that there's examples of each of these protocols that are actually running today at each of these layers. And that's really been the context of the second book that I wrote, Building the Mobile Internet.
So then can you further discuss the concept of mobility and identifying the evolving mobility requirements?
Sure. So mobility, I think, has always had a broad range of definitions depending on who you speak to. It can be as simple as the ability to take my laptop from my home here and travel across the country, open it up again, and connect to the Internet, something known as nomadic mobility. It can be even more complex as what's called seamless mobility, the ability to maintain my connection. So I'm in my car surfing the web from my phone, and I maintain my connection as my device moves. There's further thoughts around things like session continuity, which is the ability of my existing VPN sessions. Maybe you consider a VPN session to your company and having those sessions continue as my device moves. And if we look at even further some of the service models that just generically exist today, you'll see that mobility is everywhere, right? We can look at Akamai and Akamai using their content delivery networks as a means to move content around. We can look at cloud providers using virtual machines as a means to move application environments across hardware. We can look at voice providers and using call anchor points as a means to move phone calls between devices. So mobility, you know, it's a big umbrella term, I think, at this point that's used to classify many different types of applications and services of which users consume.
Well, you know, you're going to be in the ideal position. So what are the key mobility market trends?
So I think I touched on some of those above, but I think that, you know, when we look at the history of mobility and my entire history working in this space, I've seen analyst after analyst come out with the question of, you know, what is the next killer app that will drive mobile growth? You know, how will users adopt 3G and why will users adopt 3G? What's the service you're going to provide to the user that's going to be so compelling that they're going to sign up for 3G? And now during this transition to LTE, some of the analysts are looking at that question again, saying, what's the killer app driving 4G? And I think that what we're finally seeing is recognition across the industry that the killer app is mobility itself and the way mobility and location inherently change communications. We can see that mobility and location have changed the way search is implemented by Google. We can see that social networking has changed based on mobility and location as it's implemented by Facebook. And it's still a big learning process, right? I think that, you know, the way we've seen the first evolution of the internet and the growth of the first internet has been the ability to exploit communications to devices. The next wave of the evolution of the internet, and we're still learning here, will be largely based on being able to exploit mobility and location within the context of those communications.
What about authentication for users moving across networks and operators?
So authentication, security, without a doubt, those are key. You know, when I talk to customers about cloud or mobility, security always tends to bubble up to the top of the list, right? You know, when I talk to IT organizations and within enterprise and we talk cloud or we talk security, I can see the CIO's light bulb go off. They hear cloud, they think security. They hear mobility, they think security, right? So, but there's still a lot of discrepancy around what level of security is really needed, right? Within the service provider and provider environment in general, when a subscriber is connected to their home network or the network that they have a billing relationship with, security is nothing more than just making sure that the subscriber is authenticated to connect. But when the user starts to roam outside of their home network, especially onto untrusted wireless technologies like Wi-Fi, security is not just about authentication, and more it's about protecting the operator assets from malicious or in some cases even inadvertent attacks. So absolutely, you know, authentication and security and being able to ensure that those security parameters hold true as the user moves are key to the deployment and adoption of mobility.
Now, if we can drill down then, how can you address mobility at the data link layer?
So link layer mobility, what link layer mobility allows is layer 2 points of attachment to change without impacting sessions. To a large degree, the internet doesn't break during layer 2 transitions because the internet layer outside of a network that's directly connected to the element that moved is really unaware of the change. However, if you look at an entire IP communication stream from end to end, once you reach that last leg, it involves being able to locate the physical hardware or the MAC address, as well as which interface or where that MAC address is attached to the network. That's where layer 2 mobility starts to break. And there's two predominant techniques that have been used today to resolve this. The largest deployed case you can think of is GPRS tunneling protocol, or GTP, which runs the foundation for most mobile operators in the world today. So anyone running on the 3GPP standards, such as, you know, Vodafone, AT&T are running that, some of the large ones, for example. And then the transition to LTE technologies, which certainly is the big buzzword in the industry today, will also be a foundation built upon GTP. The other key protocol that we see there is proxy mobile IP. Proxy mobile IP is the underlying mobility technology of WiMAX systems.
How can you use the network layer solutions to deliver seamless mobility and session continuity?
So aside from the GTP and PMIP cases that I kind of just talked about, the network layer is another very prevalent location today for seeing the deployment of mobility techniques. And what the network layer solutions tend to provide is a means of unoverloading IP addresses, meaning that providing the separation of the location and the identity components of the IP address. How is this done? By providing every subscriber or every end node with essentially two IP addresses. One IP address is the subscriber's identity. The other IP address is the subscriber's location. In order to reach a particular identity, a node in the network plays a role of encapsulation or tunneling traffic inside the location. So from an internet perspective, you know, a web server that sits out on the internet thinks it's communicating directly with a specific identity, and then there's some intermediary node within the network that provides a tunneling mechanism and continues to track the linkage between a subscriber's identity and a subscriber's location as mobility occurs. So to a large degree, the role of the network has been to obscure the complexities of mobility from the two nodes that are either moving or in a communication session.
So what insights can you provide about integrating mobility functionality into the transport and session layer?
So this has largely been a very debatable approach to this point. Much of the work done at the transport session layer has been academic. There are some well-defined protocols here, such as Session Control Transport Protocol, SCTP, or I guess to a lesser extent, Multipath TCP, that are used to provide the ability to support multiple interfaces simultaneously. And if you consider what support of multiple interfaces simultaneously is, in general, it's really a mobility technique. There are other techniques, again, I mentioned largely academic, things like Transport Layer Mobility Protocol or MSOX that's been shown to provide a proxy functionality within the network, which allows sessions to be established in both directions with the proxy. And the role of this proxy itself is designed to support mobility, track changes on the location on either side, and obscure those changes from the other communicating host.
Now, can you extend the last question to add mobility functionality to the application layer, including support for moving media sessions between devices?
Sure, absolutely. Now, this is where the world, I think, has gotten a bit more interesting, because there are a number of protocols at the application layer that inherently support mobility. Protocols like HTTP and SIP. We see SIP probably the larger one at moving media sessions today, but certainly HTTP is capable of doing the same. Even using things like a dynamic naming service such as Dynamic DNS allows locations to change because that updated location can be immediately communicated to the naming system. I still think that there's many opportunities to continue to develop applications to be aware of, or I guess at least tolerant to mobility.
Now, what are your tips on redesigning internet architecture to enable long-term improvements to mobility?
So I think I kind of just concluded on one in the last question, and my advice would be to build applications to be tolerant to mobility. Historically, applications and internet protocols of the world have been built without mobility in mind, or at least mobility to be considered the exception to the rule. Going forward, I think that building applications with a recognition that mobility is the rule will greatly improve performance of those applications. Second, I look to IPv6. Right, there are just too many devices that will connect to the mobile internet to continue using NAT techniques for scale. I think our CTO, Cisco CTO, pointed to 1 trillion things connected to the internet by 2014. Regardless of how much NAT or proxies you put in your network or the use of private IP addressing space, you're not going to scale to support 1 trillion things connected to the internet using IPv4. And third, there's really no one-size-fits-all model for mobility. I think that we shouldn't expect one technique will win, whether it be network layer, or transport layer, or link layer, or application layer, but instead we should continue to expect to see what we've always seen implemented in the internet, and that being that multiple protocols and multiple techniques will get deployed, and it becomes incumbent upon the network and network infrastructure vendors to provide the interworking between those protocols.
I guess this is a really key question, though. You know, what are the user expectations?
So it's key, and Stephen, it's surprisingly simple, right? The user expectation is that they want a good experience and access to any service they want at any time on any device. It's certainly very simple to expect, but I think it's the traditional iceberg problem, that being that delivering simple expectations tends to require a ton of complexity within the infrastructure.
So what about digital media delivery over mobile networks?
So Cisco releases every 6 months called the Visual Networking Index. The Visual Networking Index released in February pointed to 66% of mobile internet traffic being video. Now, I know that folks have historically said, you know, the mobile internet's not that big. There's not a lot of traffic generated from mobile devices yet. So even video itself is not overly impacting to the internet when it's delivered to a mobile device. One thing to look at also within that VNI statistics is that last year's mobile internet traffic was 3 times the total traffic that the whole of the internet had in the year 2000. So it's important to continue to remember that mobile traffic is growing exponentially. The demand for mobile video is really leading that charge. And the impact of mobile video is much more, is much beyond just looking at the spectrum crunch, but also looking at the impact to overall IP networks as well as the health of the internet.
Now, can you describe the bandwidth and spectrum crunch? I think you touched on some of this, but go into more detail.
Sure. I think that, you know, that there's always going to be a bandwidth crunch. I don't think that any operator will ever tell you that they have enough spectrum or that what they have is sufficient from a resource perspective, and they'll always look for more. There's been a statistic put out from Ericsson, though, that points to the fact that in a dense urban area, the vast majority of radio sites still use less than 5% of their capacity. So the question becomes, why do operators feel they have a spectrum crunch, or why do they feel they have a bandwidth crunch when we're still not using all the resources that are available at the cell site? And the reason being that to a large degree, what's tend to happen in the way mobile networks were built is that they've been built for coverage models. And when you build a network for coverage, you tend to add lots of towers in order to ensure that you can cover every user within a given geographic area. What happens as you start to deploy lots of towers is you start to have lots of interference. As you start to have lots of interference, it limits the total availability and capabilities of the spectrum that you have. So I wouldn't say that we're so much in a spectrum crunch right now as much as looking for techniques and tools in order to free up and increase the usability of the spectrum that we have. Where we are starting to see a bandwidth crunch is in the last mile access to cell sites. And reason being that we're starting to see a bandwidth crunch there, is two reasons. One is operators have continued to deploy with oversubscription models in the backhaul. And oversubscription models in the backhaul are very well suited to protocols like HTTP or web browsing type of techniques. But as you start to see more video type or streaming applications running, oversubscribing backhaul becomes more difficult to do. The challenge, of course, being that, you know, we have TDM lines and we have circuit switch technologies for the backhaul today, and certainly there's the evolution towards optical and the deployment of microwave technologies and packet backhaul, but I still don't think that that's happening fast enough in order to keep up with demand.
You know, there's over 3 billion smartphones, tablets, and mobile devices, so what is their impact on enterprise IT organizations?
So it's Cisco certainly is, we eat our own dog food here in that we're out encouraging the use of the internet and mobility for enterprise functions and enterprise capabilities. And as such, you'll look across the typical Cisco environment, and there are certainly, I would say that a vast majority have smartphones today. Tablets are becoming more prevalent. So we're certainly at the forefront of seeing the impact of this. And, you know, I mentioned early on security as one consideration. And you also need to think about how security plays into plays out with location embedded on top of it, right? And that being that, you know, there's confidential information that you have within an organization. How do you leverage location and mobility to understand that users may not always have access to certain confidential information based on where they are? But even more importantly, I think that there's a lot of good things that can come from layering location onto an enterprise IT organization. We just saw a big natural disaster happen in Japan, right? With the ability of leveraging location, Cisco or an enterprise IT organization can look and see what users' smartphones were in the vicinity and track who's safe and who's not safe. So I think that the capabilities of integrating mobility and wireless into enterprise IT organizations is still very much in its infancy. The capabilities and potential will be much more than enabling access to corporate data, but also providing unique capabilities and unique ways to leverage that data based on the device and location of the users.
You know, computing professionals are just so busy and there's so much noise out there. So how do they sort through all of that noise to find out the best resources to get more information? And I think you're sort of in the ideal spot as this noted international expert. So what are your top recommended resources and why?
So It would be wrong of me to not put in my shameless plug for my two books. I would certainly recommend those as resources for anyone looking to further understand the role of IP as well as how mobility is becoming natively embedded on the internet. But on top of that, you know, it was a good learning process for me writing both of the books, and that being recognition that I did not have all the knowledge that I needed. And I tended to use Google quite a bit. I think there's always the need to separate marketing from reality in terms of what can actually be delivered in terms of services. And, you know, another key trend, and I see this, you know, we talked about it a bit earlier, is that I'm seeing more and more that resources tend to be connected through your social community. So leveraging Facebook, leveraging LinkedIn as a means to expand your knowledge and contacts within the industry, I found to be very beneficial.
Kevin, can you name those two books again?
Sure. The first book published in 2009 was called IP Design for Mobile Networks, and the second book published in February 2011 was called Building the Mobile Internet. Both books are available through standard book sellers, Amazon, for instance. You can also buy them on the Cisco Press website.
I guess the other thing is, and maybe this is a difficult question, but are there maybe one or two conferences that you would recommend people attend?
Sure. So, you know, Mobile World Congress, it's in Spain. It's a lot of fun. There's a lot of really neat technology there. It tends to be very focused on what operators, network infrastructure vendors are delivering. I always highly recommend that one. The other one I look at is I look at the Consumer Electronics Show. And the reason being is that network capabilities and what operators are able to deliver to consumers is all well and good, but you need the devices and capabilities to consume that. And Consumer Electronics Show has shifted its focus, at least from my perspective, to encompassing a lot around mobile devices. You know, there were a number of big press releases this year at Mobile World Congress in 2011. The biggest one that I saw was NVIDIA's announcement that their Tegra processors in the mobile devices by the end of this year will be faster than the fastest laptop CPUs. So imagine having a low power consuming chipset in a mobile device that can outperform your laptop. Just imagine the capabilities and potential.
And then let's extend that. Are there any sort of publications like journals or magazines that you'd recommend?
So I do read Network World quite a bit. I read Inform IT quite a bit. Most of these are online publications that I tend to subscribe to. The other ones that I spend quite a bit of time reading that tends to have a lot of good information are the ones put out by Fierce Wireless. So there's Fierce Mobile, there's Fierce Mobile IT, there's Fierce Wireless, there's Fierce IPTV. All of these tend to have some mobile-centric elements to them.
And I guess lastly, are there any nonprofit professional societies you belong to?
So I spend some time within IEEE. I spend some time within IETF. But in general, most of my work is not on the nonprofit side.
Now, in your travels and all the work that you do, do you have any one, two, or three stories that you could share? Maybe something surprising or unexpected, amazing?
I do. You know, it's in traveling, it's always very interesting to see how wireless technologies are consumed by different cultures. And you know, traveling worldwide, I've been fortunate to get a lot of perspective and see some really interesting uses of wireless that I certainly wouldn't have thought of, right? When I traveled to Korea back in 2003, I think it was, right? It was the first time I ever saw ringback tones. And it was a service provider who had deployed the ability to, you know, for you to select what someone else hears when you call them rather than a standard ringing. And it's funny because it's not a service that was well known at the time. It was certainly not popular or being thought of in terms of a deployment by a lot of mobile operators. And Cisco as a company didn't even have a radar on this, yet there it was being deployed. And I went to talk to that operator while I was in Korea, and they were doing it with Cisco technology. So it's always funny, right, when you provide the tools to see what can be created with those tools. There was a time when I was in Japan where I watched five or six people on a bus get together and sing karaoke using the karaoke coming over a wireless connection to their mobile phone on speakerphone. So it's always interesting, I think, and unexpected to see how wireless technologies are consumed. And it's not a question of how much bandwidth you provide, because there will never be enough bandwidth. Users will always find a way to consume the bandwidth that they're given. What will be interesting to see in the next generation of LTE networks and what happens with DSL-like or cable modem-like speeds over a wireless connection is how users consume that connection different from how they consume a standard DSL or a cable line.
You're a Cisco Distinguished Systems Architect. What does that mean? How did it come about?
So Cisco's had the Distinguished Program in time for a long time. I think that there's a number of leaders within Cisco that are well-suited to lead in technical, architectural, and business model shifts, but aren't well-suited to manage people or don't have interest in managing people and prefer to continue to contribute to technological or development excellence. And therefore, the creation of the distinguished role and the fellow role within Cisco have appeared. I've recently been promoted here in the last year to a distinguished engineer on the sales side focused on mobility with a focus around where I see in 5 to 10 years the evolution of the mobile internet, the mobile architecture, and what the trends are that are driving those evolutions.
Now, here's a bit of a broader question. You know, you're a computing professional. I'm a computing professional. You know, what are your thoughts on computing being a recognized profession like medicine or engineering, accounting, law, with demonstrated professional development, adherence to the code of ethics, and recognized credentials?
No, that's the first time about 10 years ago that I told someone I was an engineer, their response was, "That's really cool. You drive trains?" So it was a very funny response. I think that the engineering profession is certainly growing, right? I think that putting it on the same level of medicine and law, the reason I don't think it sits on that same level is that people know how to consume the services that a doctor offers them. People know how to consume the services that a lawyer offers them. I don't think yet that people understand that they're constantly consuming the innovations and capabilities that that engineers and computing professionals deliver to them. That being said, you know, the second half of your question, which is, you know, adherence to a continued code of conduct, being able to create globally recognized credentials. I think that the adherence to the code of ethics is something that that shouldn't be restricted to any organization. I think that ethics in medicine and law are much the same as ethics in computing and engineering need to be taken into consideration, especially with a global community that is capable of exploiting any breaches of ethics, whether it be security vulnerabilities in software or failure to implement something in hardware. And globally recognized credentials, you know, we can certainly point to the CCIE program as a globally recognized program, the Cisco Certified Internet Network Expert. With the large number of Cisco Learning Centers that we have around the world, I think it is certainly a recognized credential. The MCSE or Microsoft System Certified Engineers recognized credential. I know that there's that the IETF and IEEE COMSOC community has standardized a wireless certified engineer credential, WCE, and they have a training program that delivers certification as well. So I think that the certification and credentials are certainly growing and becoming globally recognized.
We're down to our last question, and this one's a little bit of a free-form question. So, Kevin, you know, what questions should I have asked you, and then what would be your answers?
So I think that we tended to spend a lot of time in our interview looking at how the network is ready to respond to the shifting demands of what users are going to be doing and how services will be implemented. And I think the bigger questions, and ones that it's certainly not for me to answer, but for the entire internet community to answer, is how are we going to innovate? How are we going to take the capabilities that the network delivers to us and exploit them to do things that 5 years ago seemed unfathomable, right? What are those applications and what are those services that are going to drive new ways of communication and improved social communities around the world? How are we going to take the wireless technologies and mobile technologies that are evolving with LTE and use them to help the world? And I don't necessarily think, as I said, that those are questions for me as much as they're questions for, I hope, all the folks who listen to this podcast do hear and listen to and start to think about.
Well, Kevin, you are a Cisco Distinguished professional and highly recognized worldwide for your innovation and holding 15 patents, writing books, speaking at conferences, doing podcasts. We will continue to follow your significant and historical contributions, and we thank you for sharing your deep insights and wisdom with our audience.
Thank you, Stephen.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Kevin Schatzkammer, author, internationally renowned distinguished systems architect on the evolution and long-term strategy of mobile networks.